I thought then about King Arthur, the ancient mythical Hyborian king, and felt that it must be he who had come to bring blessing to his people, and that the whole ceremony had symbolized a form of crucifixion, showing the people how to bring about the overcoming of man's fleshly or material self, the slaying, equals kill, of the dragon of evil within themselves and the subsequent resurrection of the eternal spirit of Christ ever indwelling in man's heart. All those present were called upon to assist in this divine ascension. The foregoing message tells us that the dragon symbolized the powers of darkness or evil in this ancient land, and as shelter and savior against these attacking powers came, the great being called by many names, but symbolizing always the inmost spirit of man, his innate divinity, his power of self-redemption and sacrifice, symbolizing also the inmost spirit of the nation. It will be seen that in the first vision, this being, this great knight of the spirit, is linked with the personality of Saint George, and in the second, but earlier one, he is called Arthur. The reference is not presumably to the historical Arthur, who led Britain against the Saxon invader, nor is it only to the King Arthur who, with his knights of the Round Table, has come down to us in legend and folk tale, for the legend itself comes down from a far more ancient past. From that being, Arthur, who, mystically, is the very spirit of Britain, who guides her destiny and will lead her to victory over the powers of evil. He is called in the vision a Hyborian king. This brings home a belief set forth by occult tradition, to the effect that there once existed a continent of this name situated to the north of Britain, Hyboria, literally, the land above the north, which eventually sank beneath the sea. Tradition says that Hyboria was inhabited by a race of initiates or wise men. This would account, perhaps, for the many messages, which affirm contact or communion with these same wise men in Britain. Our teacher, White Eagle, has this to say. The God-men of Hyboria. In the beginning, the earth was peopled by perfect sons of God who came in all their glory as guardians of a young race on a young planet. These God-men, great and wise brothers, brought the knowledge of the power of the spiritual Son or Christ to the earth. They came first to the land of Hyboria, whose very stones became impregnated with the light they brought to earth. In the course of time these great and wise brothers journeyed across the northern hemisphere taking with them the truth of the light of the sun. Knowledge of sun worship, of the power of the light, swept across the world from that original northern continent of Hyboria, from the great sun brotherhood. What you now call Great Britain was once a part of that ancient continent and later of Atlantis. Many of the ancient peoples journeyed here and established here in Britain centers of great spiritual life and power, and this light still lies buried deeply in the very soil of your land. Because of this light, there is in Britain a spiritual power, which can and will in future work through all the people of these islands. Scientists say that in the ancient days the earth was peopled by primitive creatures, but which of you, even your greatest scientists, can judge of what happened so long ago? The age of the earth and of earth's humanity is beyond man's calculation. We know that it is far, far older than has ever been estimated, and there have been many changes in the earth's surface, and cataclysms, which have caused the water to roll where land now exists, and land to be where water is now. There have been civilizations and continents now submerged, of which this world knows nothing. We know that ever since the earth was peopled, it has passed through ages of varying consciousness. The human race is not very evolved today, but it will become great again when this secret power has been released and the whole vibration of the earth thereby raised. Man himself contains the secret of good or evil. At present the greatest pull would seem to be to evil or to the negative aspect. Man has to make an effort ere the good, the true and the beautiful can dominate his nature. When he can recover from selfishness and overcome this downward pull, then the whole earth will change. Could it be that this place where we are now sitting, this Dragon Hill, is one of the ancient sites where the God-men once dwelt and left their light and blessing for future races of men? 4. The Silversmith of Souls. For ages afterwards, The earth elementals, the nature and air spirits, and even the angels themselves have watched over these holy places in Britain, so that even those who are insensitive to spiritual things find themselves drawn thither. They think they go because the place is of historic interest or natural beauty, but we say that within each man is a quality, which is attracted by and responds to the influence and the power of these magical places. W.E. We have again climbed up the great trackway, having first stood upon the ramparts of the earthwork fortification called Uffington Castle, which crowns the down, marveling at the patient industry, which brought it into being, the infinite labor, which went to its construction. And now we set our faces westward to follow the wide ridgeway where all of ancient Britain once walked. We tread upon their very tracks. Their blood and substance is in our bodies yet, and out on this high place we dimly feel ourselves sharers in their humanity and spirit. The trackway itself brings this feeling to life in us, the atmosphere and scent of the downlands is charged with it. The very ground beneath our feet was once trodden by them, and the turf we tread has grown over and healed many holes and scars, which once defaced our trackway, has covered them with its green resilience, and is still gentle to our feet. We walk westward towards the sun, with all the Thames Valley, where once the swamp men lived their tunnelled lives, spread out to the north, and before us the rolling downs where our hillmen ancestors walked. What manner of men were these ancestors of ours? We have seen some of their mighty works, which after centuries of weather, attack are still impressive. Most touching of all, we have stood on the barrows where they buried their beloved dead, one would believe with infinite care and reverence, even affording them food and the wherewithal to eat it on their passage to the next world. We know that these peoples were also in touch with Egypt and with Egyptian customs of burial, for beads of Egyptian necklaces have been found within the burial mounds. Some believe that Egypt itself was once a colony of Atlantis. These hill men must have faithfully believed that their dead lived on afterwards, and that an unseen but real beneficence ruled their destinies and had power to change the fierce swamp men if they, the hill men, played their part. The few thousand years ago we cite are but a tale of yesterday. What of that sweeter, brighter age of long before, of those more brotherly times when it is said men lived for perhaps double our present lifespan, wise and intelligent, and close to their beneficent God? To find out these things we have become pilgrims, like many others who in days gone by have walked the great ridge way. During our present walk we have traversed perhaps a mile, and now come upon a pile of great stones heaped under a grove of mature beech trees. This is Wayland Smithy, known the world over. Had we ridden here in a mythical long ago, and had our steed cast its shoe and left its rider stranded on these lonely downs, then all that had to be done was for us to tie up that horse hard by the smithy and steal away, not to witness secret magic, first depositing on the stone a silver coin, of some value, please understand. On our return we would have found our steed magically reshod, maybe with a silver shoe, although legend is not certain on this point. At any rate, this is how the centuries-old tale goes, reaching back as far as memory can tell, and embodying a far older myth, for it refers to an ancient mystical teaching about the god-shod feet or the god-guided initiate, sometimes symbolized by golden shoes. In actual fact, our little party of three had reached Wayland Smithy some hours before its visit to Dragon Hill, and was fortunate enough to spend an hour there alone, first walking round the long barrow examining the massive stone, beneath which some honored person had been buried long ago. Everything was favorable. The day was blessed, bright and kindly, and above all no people were around. Having sensed the atmosphere, we settled ourselves comfortably, and the message began to come through. Impressions at Wayland Smithy. According to archaeology, Wayland Smithy is a Neolithic burial chamber in a long barrow edged with stones. Beneath the mouth is a smaller long barrow of earlier date, with burials in a wooden chamber. The message runs, "I heard music, harmony, singing and chanting whilst we were approaching the entrance. This was once a sun temple and place of initiation. Candidates for initiation came to this spot in the very early days of prehistoric Britain. I contact a ceremony similar to those I have seen connected with the Mayans. I can see that a special perambulation, means walking around, of the brethren took place here on Midsummer Day. Then they would stand, waiting for the sun to rise. I can feel a concentration of the rays of the sun and other planets rested on this center, which became a place of power and worship, bringing about the opening of human consciousness, and unveiling to men knowledge of the real meaning of human life. I feel there were initiations here of young men and women who were ready to follow the path of service. There was once a very wise priest living here. I see that he was a big man with long hair and beard, wearing robes of a material woven in primary colors, yellow, blue and red. They studied the heavens here, and I think they even received communications from other planets. Now I see that this priest was nationless, a universal being possessing great wisdom and knowledge, who lived here for many ages. All around I can see a camp, not of soldiers, but a traveler's camp, built to accommodate people who had come from far and wide. It looks to me almost like an Indian encampment. The land around is very fertile and has been so for many thousands of years since the time when this land was part of the Atlantean country. For a very ancient to Atlantean life once flourished here, this country, Britain, might even have been an island off the coast of Atlantis. The reason why this spot has since been called Wayland Smithy is that many travelers came here seeking for knowledge, direction and guidance from the center of initiates. They were reshod so that they might travel onwards. On going even further back into antiquity, I can see that a great light was concentrated here. I am now in what appears to be a cave. It is a place of worship. I can see a stone altar, embellished by gifts of fruit and sheaves of wheat. These symbols indicate the richness of the harvest, the beauty enriching the lives of the people. I can see that birds and animals of all kinds have come into this temple to share in the blessing. This is a lovely, lovely place, a place of sunshine, happiness and plenty. All this happened long before history as we know it began. Particularly interesting is the jewelry worn by the people. They made such very beautiful jewelry. Stones were set in gold and silver, and beautiful beads were used. I also see crowns, headdresses, bracelets and pottery, where the colors are also bright and impressive, like the colors of flowers. All these people have died and been buried in this lovely countryside. I myself feel a definite link with these people, and also a connection with the very ancient Indians of America. They were a gentle, cultured people. It seems as though all this happened before the world sank into its depths of materialism. This spot is sacred because here lie the bones of children and adults, of early kings and queens, of the priests, teachers and even of the initiate head of the people. This had certainly been a center where men could find initiation into inner truths of life. I feel a connection here with Stonehenge. Here the message ends. A pilgrim to the smithy might very well be defined as a waylander, or someone who wends his way across strange lands, and who can easily grow wearied or lost. In other words, his horse, his outer or worldly self, has lost a shoe and become lame. Then at last he comes to that smithy where the kindly smith waits to succor all weary waylanders. But first the waylander must make sacrifice by surrendering something precious to him, say, his silver coin. In other words, some of his worldliness must be foregone, his outer worldly self must humbly sink into abeyance during his initiation of soul and spirit. Even his horse has to become renewed, or reshod. Afterwards he goes forth to seek new tracks across the waylands, not so much across the earthly as across the heavenly places. Thus it would appear that Wayland Smithy was an ancient center of power to which travelers on life's journey came for instruction and initiation into the higher mysteries. Is there a link, perhaps, between the priest figure described, and the Arthur already referred to in the previous chapter? All this happened before the race sank into its depths of materialism. These words would seem to take us back to an even earlier time than the vision of Dragon Hill, before humanity had as yet descended to live altogether a bodily life in a physical environment. This statement denies by implication the accepted theory of evolution, and substitutes instead what the Book of Genesis affirms, that man's soul first descended from on high, and that man is fundamentally a spiritual being made in God's image. He lingered for a while on the edge of incarnation, living in a kind of Garden of Eden before descending fully in earthliness, or, as Genesis says, taking on coats of skin. What White Eagle has to say on this subject also throws light on the battle waged between good and evil already referred to, and the reason for that constant battle. White Eagle says, "Scientific thought and teaching of the past century has compelled thinking men to throw aside the old story of the Garden of Eden, yet if you study ancient wisdom, you will find much the same legend in the records of many a civilization, which in its turn has risen and passed away. You will say, but how can we reconcile the myth of the Garden of Eden and the fall with the theory of the physical evolution of man? If man has evolved through many stages of bodily adaptation, how can you account for the story of the fall? Again, you hear us say that man was once a far more spiritual being than man of today, and that in a far off age there were God-men on the earth, and you wonder, if God-men dwelt on earth long ago, why is man still apparently at so low a state of spiritual consciousness? Man descended from his higher state in accordance with the divine plan. He had to undergo a process of gradual descent to inhabit a physical vehicle, which in its turn had evolved from a lower state of life, stage by stage until the brain had developed to such a degree that it could begin to comprehend the glory and the wonder of the God within. Man contains God, the divine essence, within his own soul. But it takes long ages for that seed of God life to manifest through physical consciousness. Conceive of man in a stage of life before he came into his fuller powers of action and thought. At that time his physical body was not like the one to which you are now accustomed, for the spirit or consciousness was more outside than within the body, existing still in a higher state of life. For remember, there had to be not only a process of creating a physical vehicle, but also of developing all the subtler bodies, which clothe the spirit of man. Stage by stage not only his body, but also the mind and brain of man has evolved, until at last came the vehicle through which the divine light might descend until, in the perfect man, the full consciousness of the divine life could manifest. Many people, believing in the omnipotence of God, do not care to accept that there could ever be a fall of man. Yet if we look at it aright, we witness, not a depraved being falling because of knowledge of creation through the sex function, but rather see the process of awakening in man of his self-consciousness, leading eventually to God consciousness. This is the whole purpose of life and evolution, this growth from unconsciousness, through self-consciousness, towards God consciousness. Love of power is the basis of most of that which is called evil. Desire for power which rises in the mind and asserts that self, which is the lower aspect of man. So man fell from his perfect God-like estate, tempted by what is called evil, by his own love of power. Yet the agency of the serpent, which brought evil into the mind of man, also caused development and growth of his individual soul and mind. Evil produces individualization, a necessary part of the process of evolution, for without this pushing forward of the self, this individualization, there would be little urge towards growth in God's child towards the ideal of a completed, perfected Son of God. With the implanting of the seed of evil, as man miscalls it, or of desire for self-growth, was also born within the heart of man yet another aspect of God, called the Son, who represents the divine life, which is also love itself. So, while this desire for self-growth and self-expression became implanted in man's brain, or mind, and has been attributed to evil, there was also born within man's heart, that which is called love, the Son of God, the Christ, the light whom angels worship, and even the angels of darkness bow down to, for even they are still subject to the power of love. Good and evil are like two wheels, which are yet one, ever at work, the higher and the lower, the action of the lower ever brings suffering, but a suffering destined to produce the perfect archetype, the perfected Christ man. Have we not told you that all men shall be raised up to the sun, shall become at one with the radiance of the sun? Another of the fantastic crop symbols in the area, showing this is old sacred ground. V. The King's Men. Man's life on earth is like a seed bed in which the divine seed, man's spirit, is planted. His seed casing, or husk, is his physical body, in which his soul and spirit will live nourished by earth experiences until that seed quickens and responds to the spiritual sunlight coming from above. Man in his inner self is made in God's own image. In the first instance the divine mind created him perfect, but he has since descended or strayed far from that ideal. Now he arises to struggle again towards perfection. W.E. A few days after our visit to Dragon Hill and Weyland's Smithy, we drove northward into the Cotswolds to visit the Rollright Stones, which proved to be a circle of smallish standing stones, some of which had been cracked into several pieces by frost and weather. Separated from the main body of the stones by the road is another, the King's Stone, some 7 feet high. Legend affirms that these stones represent a king and his army turned to stone by a witch, and the Cromge, a group of whispering knights who conspired against their king. The legend is thus in line with several others, such as that of the dancing maidens in Cornwall, turned to stone for presuming to dance on the Sabbath. Once yearly the Rollright Circle receives a special visitation from the local villagers. One had the impression on arrival at the circle that here was a place, which to some degree had been spoiled. We subsequently learnt that the stones had been much tampered with by villagers and were no longer in their original position, which may partly account for that feeling. But it did not seem so when the message began to come through, for we felt at once the power that had been present, and the blessing. Here is the message, spoken beside the King's Stone, well away from the actual circle. The Rollright Stones. According to archaeology, the Rollright Stones comprise an unditched stone circle used for ritual purposes during the Bronze Age. I feel that beneath this stone circle was a burial place. Before this it was a ritual temple, but later races used it as a burial place. There was once a temple of worship here. I hear the padding of feet, I feel men and women perambulating outside, and then going into a cave underground. I feel we are walking on sacred, hallowed ground. The King's Stone, or the Sunstone. According to archaeology, a Kievan monument of doubtful significance. This was the point where the rays of the sun were concentrated right into the inner chamber. I hear chanting, which sounds like Om. Om. Om in invocation of the sun, in worship of the sun, in calling to the sun to quicken the seed and bring forth new life. Now I can feel a sense of release from the body, of going up into the light, and that the sun's rays are shining over all this area. I can see a congregation of people here on Midsummer's Day, coming from all directions in hundreds and thousands. This sun temple was founded long ago before Britain was Britain as we know it now. There was an underground place of worship here where the brothers used to meditate and work. They also made things here. I see there was much creative activity, perhaps in the making of jewelry. Also I feel I'm going through a long tunnel linking this place with another center. I see glorious colors as though there was a concentration of etheric or planetary rays here. This is only one of many such references in these visions. These were not savages, they were lovely people. I see the women dressed in pure white, the men wearing tunics, with headdresses. I can understand the headdresses, they are unusual, like the Norsemen wore with their horns. I think some of these people came from the north as well as the west. They also have bands round their heads, flashing stones set in gold bands. The color predominating is a brilliant amethyst. Now I see the men dressed in ceremonial cloaks and they bring young girls bearing wheat, wheat maidens. These are perhaps indicative of the age of Virgo. The King's Stone was once a central point, situated right in the center of the sun power, which was attracted to it by the ritual, This was the point from which they sent out the rays. It was both a projecting and receiving station. I feel there was a battle going on all the time on the etheric plane, because the dark people living in the marshes could send out astral and etheric creatures to carry out their missions of mischief. They, too, had an occult knowledge, so could do this. There was a continual pull between the forces of good and evil, which appeared as armies on the inner planes. These marsh people lived just outside the physical, in the etheric, but a very real life in etheric matter was theirs. Here the message at the roll writes tones ends. This vision may well refer to the age of Virgo, at the beginning of a fresh sun cycle, when a new race, a new outbreathing of souls, came forth. Since the opposite sign to Virgo is Pisces, the vision of the swamp men may well refer to the great ocean of psychic and elemental life, out of which the new race was being born. It would be a time of a great outpouring of light and creative power, which would be used by the god men from other planets, and those of the previous cycle who had elected to remain behind as guardians of the new race. Would these not be the hillmen, whose work would be to guard the new humanity from the men of the swamps, that is to say, from the forces of darkness and chaos, possibly finding embodiment in those left behind from the great weighing up of the cycle just completed? There would no doubt be ceremonies with the emphasis on the sowing of the corn, and the maidens with the corn sheaves would not only be symbolic, but help to draw down the protective power of the Divine Mother to guard the new cycle of souls, or even perhaps to draw it forth from the dark ocean of unformed life symbolized by Pisces, opposite sign to Virgo. The Spirit of God moved on the face of the waters. The reference to the creative use of sound is significant, and is only one of several such allusions we shall find as the story unfolds. It calls to mind much later experiences at Karnak in Brittany, with its huge array of stone alignments, similar to, but on a vaster scale than anything known in Britain. We have already learnt that some form of communication existed between our men of the hills and the people of Brittany, and therefore the following account of the vision at Karnak in April 1970 may all be part of the present story. Karnak. Music. Music. The air was full of this powerful music and rhythm. Then the jubilant company of people gradually came into my vision colorfully clad, principally in the colors of the sun. They performed graceful ritual dances, over and over again, mostly in circular motion, swaying, bending. Directing it all were three wise and ancient officiants. The whole company seemed to be under a powerful magic force. They were gay and full of laughter. I was struck by their gaiety and strength of purpose. At several of the menhir alignments at Manek, I immediately picked up the continuous beat of music, the air seemed to be impregnated with it. I also received the impression of a Masonic order. These prehistoric people were the original Masons, and I was being shown how these stone temples and alignments of stone were formed, by sound and song. The white ether which is everywhere was either the power or the substance used to create form on a physical plane. It would appear that these very ancient peoples, before history, had knowledge of spiritual, and indeed natural law, far beyond anything we note today. They knew of the creative power of sound and rituals, they knew of the movement of the stars, and the influence of the other planets of the solar system on the Earth. Above all, they knew how to use the spiritual light and solar force. Roll Right itself, we learn, was a center of power for the reception and radiation of the light of solar and planetary rays for the blessing of the Earth. White Eagle says, throughout the ages the light of the ancient Sun Brothers has been centered within, although not confined to this mystic isle, which was a sacred isle thousands upon thousands of years ago. The Brethren of the Ancient Light traveled all over the earth, but their home was this mystic isle. If you study the inner history of your land, you will come to realize that throughout the ages a tradition concerning the light of the sun has lingered in your myths and legends and folklore. When once you have studied, contemplated and meditated with greater power and understanding, you will be able to read the story of the very early Sun Brotherhoods who once lived here, who built temples, who worshipped here, who possessed great knowledge, not only of spiritual truth, but of physics, of the properties of matter, knowledge which was imparted to those who came seeking. We would stress how the spiritual life and influence of these God-men still lingers in your land, and in the hearts of her people. The British people are grown blind and deaf, and do not know the beautiful secrets which are hidden here. You are the inheritors of an ancient wisdom, a great light. We visit the trodden underfoot cathedral.